Well, we're now going on to Unit 2, starting with a chapter that's called The Structure and Function of Large Biological Molecules, which is a good title because this chapter is all about the structure and function of large biological molecules. The ones that we've been talking about, that I've already given you the four categories of, what are those categories? By large molecules, we're talking about macromolecules.
Proteins
is one.
Lipids.
Polyacides. What is it?
Polysaccharides.
Yes. And what's the fourth?
Nucleic acids,
right. Now, that's the four categories. They're all large molecules by comparison to run-of-the-mill molecules like water and oxygen. They're not all equally big. Lipids aren't quite as big as the other three. But there's also another distinction. Even though all of those four are macromolecules, only three of those four categories qualify as polymers. Polymers are large molecules that are built by hooking together a bunch of subunits, either the same kind of subunit over and over or different kinds of subunits. But that's what a polymer is in general. Polymer means many part. Poly, many, mer, part. The individual subunits that you put together to build polymers are called monomers, a one part subunit. Which do you think of those four categories of macromolecules is not officially a polymer? Lipids are not polymers, right. And they're not as big as the others as well, but that's not what makes them not a polymer. They're just built slightly differently. So the other three are polymers. Proteins, polysaccharides, nucleic acids are not only large biological molecules or macromolecules, they are polymers. Well, I mention that now because it's important to begin with, and we'll be talking more about it. But I mention it right away on slide one because notice that this uses a polymer as an example. But the important thing about this slide actually doesn't require the molecule to be a polymer. So what's important about this slide is true of all four categories of macromolecules, including lipids. And what's happening here is that at the top, you have a situation in which a molecule is being built, a bigger molecule is being built out of smaller pieces. All right? And on the bottom, exactly the opposite is happening. An already bigger molecule is being broken into smaller pieces. Well, there are different pieces that are used to make different categories of macromolecules. But in all four cases, pieces that are linked together, each of the two pieces that get linked together to form a bigger one, will follow this scheme. One piece will have a hydrogen hanging off of it somewhere, and the other piece will have an OH hanging off of it somewhere. That's when they're still separate pieces, separate molecules in their own right. Putting those two smaller molecules together to form a bigger molecule involves interaction between these two things, the hydrogen from one and the OH from the other. And those end up coming out, not becoming part of the final product. A hydrogen will be lost from one piece, an OH from the other piece. Well, if you think about this in terms of molecular modeling with your kits, if you take a hydrogen off of one piece and an OH off the other piece, that's going to leave a hole in each one, right? Allowing them to be bonded together. That's exactly what's happening in this top reaction, which is called a dehydration reaction, meaning removal of water, right? Dehydration means removal of water. And that makes sense because the hydrogen from one and the OH from the other become H2O that comes out. So it's removal of water, but that allows linking of the two parts into a bigger piece now. Dehydration reaction is one name for it. It also goes by the name condensation reaction. Just completely interchangeable terms for the same thing, but dehydration really tells you what happens here. Okay, so dehydration involves making bigger things out of smaller things. And we do that all the time in cells. We don't get our macromolecules from the things we eat. The food we eat contains macromolecules, but those are too big to enter our body. We don't put food into our body. We say that all the time, but we don't really. We put food into the tunnel that our body is wrapped around. The alimentary canal, which is the continuous tunnel from mouth to anus, is not really inside your body. It's kind of like the hole in a donut, right? Putting your finger through the hole in a donut does not put it into the donut. The donut's just wrapped around that. Similarly, food in your body is still outside of your body. It's continuous with the air outside. And the digestion that occurs outside of your body, breaking those big molecules into smaller ones that are then small enough to absorb into the cells that make up your body. That's when it officially enters. But by then, it's not huge molecules. We build our large molecules out of the small molecules that our food is digested into, and we build different things compared to what the big ones were in the food originally. It's like disassembling a big Lego and then making a different one out of the blocks. Well, dehydration is used all the time to make these complex molecules, but the opposite, importantly, also has to be able to happen, meaning dismantling of big molecules into smaller chunks. And that opposite of dehydration is hydrolysis. Hydro is part of this word as well, just like in dehydration, because water is involved. It's exactly the opposite. Water comes out when you link the two together because you lose an H and an OH, which become H2O. To do exactly the opposite, you have to put water into it. Water then gets split into H and OH so that one of the pieces that gets removed gets an H and the other one gets an OH to complete their models, to fill all their holes, in other words. All right? And lysis, the lysis part of the word hydrolysis means split, splitting. So it's water splitting, really. Water itself gets split, but we're using water to split a big macromolecule into smaller pieces. All right, so that happens even though this is a short polymer and an unlinked monomer being used as an example, and it's true of all the polymers, it's also true of the way lipids are built. Let's go to slide 2 now, and for the rest, that was a general slide, which was true of all the four categories. Now we're going to survey the four categories one at a time. And first up are polysaccharides, even though slide 2 doesn't show you any polysaccharides. Polysaccharides, the name tells you that these things are polymers, right? Saccharide part of the word means sugar. There are monosaccharides that are one-piece sugars, small sugars, subunits. Those are monomers. They're not macromolecules. Plenty of small sugars. And this is why I said in a previous lecture when I first was telling you about these four categories that it's not strictly true to say that carbohydrates is one of the categories, even though some textbooks will tell you that. Because not all carbohydrates are macromolecules. It's just too broad a term. Every monosaccharide is a carbohydrate, but monosaccharides are not big. You need them, though, to link them together as building blocks to form carbohydrates that are big, which are what the polysaccharides are. Polysaccharides, the word, tells you that they're made by hooking together a bunch of monosaccharides. And the monosaccharides are some monosaccharides. Just a few of very, very many possible monosaccharides are shown in slide 2. And speaking of the word carbohydrate,
I want to remind you to not confuse that word with the similar word hydrocarbon, which we've already talked about.
Carbohydrates are not hydrocarbons because hydrocarbons contain only hydrogen and carbon. Carbohydrates contain carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, as you see in all of these examples, and any monosaccharide that will be true of.
The reason they get this name, though, carbohydrate, is because they seem to have, based on their chemical formulae,
they seem to be part carbon and water. The general formula for a given monosaccharide, which we call a simple sugar,
is C, some number of C's, which we'll say is N, H, 2N, meaning there's twice as many hydrogens as carbons in a monosaccharide. So 2N, whatever N is, 2N is twice that. And then oxygen, also N.
So same number of carbons and oxygens, and twice that number of hydrogens. Now, how many there are, what N is, depends on the individual carbohydrate.
But notice that if you kind of use the distributive property, you could rewrite this chemical formula as CN, and then in parentheses, H2ON,
right? This is 2N, this is 1N. You see what I'm doing there? And if you write it this way, it looks like it's part carbon and part water. That's why they're called carbohydrates. It's not strictly true that it's part carbon and part water, but the building blocks are there. All right, so this general formula is true for all monosaccharides. And since N is a variable, that tells you that there are multiple possible monosaccharides. Well, in slide 2, we see just some examples, but notice the rows and columns here, the headers. The rows represent one way of classifying monosaccharides, and the columns represent another way of classifying monosaccharides, and they are fundamentally distinct ways. One way of classifying them has nothing to do with the other way of classifying them. Let's start with the columns. Glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone both have exactly C3H6O3 as their chemical formula. What does that tell you about these two molecules? They are isomers of each other. Isomers have identical chemical formulae, even though they are distinct molecules, right? So they're not only isomers of each other, but they're fellow monosaccharides. What's different about them, as far as the column is concerned, even though they're different molecules, is that they share exactly the same number of carbons. Right? So that not only do they share the same number of everything, but carbon is special importance. Remember, we talked about the carbon skeleton being important in organic molecules. All four of these macromolecules that we're talking about throughout this chapter are not only macromolecules, they are organic macromolecules. So they'll all have a carbon skeleton in them somewhere. Well, even though these are different, they are both three carbon monosaccharides. Each of them has three carbons in the skeleton. And that's why they are classified as trioses. So the columns are classifying monosaccharides based on how many carbons are in the skeleton. The OSE ending tells you that these things are sugars. Sugars get names that end in OSE, or carbohydrates in general. The name often ends in OSE. That tells you that it's a carbohydrate. Trioses are three carbon sugars. That's what it literally means, tri meaning three. So triose is not a substance. Triose is a category of substances. Pentoses is five carbon sugars. Hexoses are six carbon sugars because hex means six. All right. So the glucose that you built with your models is just one of many different possible hexoses. Another thing you should notice, especially because it's highlighted here, is that every monosaccharide contains this orange or salmon highlighted group, which is what? Yes, that's a carbonyl group, C double bonded to an O. All right? So, classifying them based on carbon skeleton size is one way. A completely different way of categorizing them is shown in the rows. Remember that when we studied the carbonyl functional group, there's two possible positions for that carbonyl group to appear in the carbon skeleton, right? And therefore, there are two different categories of substances containing carbonyl groups. What are the categories of compounds? Right, ketones and aldehydes. That's where I told you about the A is at the tip of the alphabet, just like in the word aldehyde. Aldehydes have their carbonyls at the tip of the carbon skeleton. Ketones have their carbonyl somewhere not at the tip of the carbon skeleton. Well, since every monosaccharide contains a carbonyl, every sugar, every monosaccharide is either a ketone or an aldehyde, depending on where that carbonyl group is. And so the rows are classifying them based on whether they are aldehydes or ketones. These ones on the top have their carbonyls at the tip of the carbon skeleton in all cases, so they are aldehyde sugars. One word that means literally aldehyde sugar is aldoses. Right, the OSE ending and the ALD telling you they're aldehydes. These ones down here don't have their carbonyls at a tip. Anywhere other than a tip qualifies them as ketones. They are ketone sugars or ketoses. Okay, let's go on to three. Now, an important thing to understand about monosaccharides, which are important for multiple reasons, but including the fact that they can be used to build bigger carbohydrates. We're building our way up to the polysaccharides. Is that any given monosaccharide can exist in either linear form or ringed form. And you can see the linear form on the left, just like the linear form of glucose that you built. It doesn't mean it's a perfect line. It simply means that the carbon skeleton doesn't wrap back and bind to itself into a ring. Okay, so this is the linear form. This is kind of halfway between. It's forming a ring, but hasn't yet. And now it's completed that bond to make that final ring. I mean, to make that ring finalized. So this is the same substance, has the same similar properties, but it's two different forms of the same substance. Linear form and ringed form. And so that's true for glucose, for instance. There's two different versions of glucose based on whether it has a ring structure, the linear form or the ring form. In general, though, that's true for monosaccharides. Now, notice that to form that ring, the sugar has to open up a hole in the model. The carbon that's involved in making the ring complete, that has to open up a hole, right? You can't just add a bond because the valence is the valence. So to make a ring, you're going to have to get rid of something from that molecule, on both of them actually. They're going to have to lose something in order to make a bond available so that the C and the O here can bond together right here. Does that make sense? And therefore, the carbonyl, which involves a double bond between oxygen, is going to become a single bond to make room for that extra bond. So what this means is that you still have a monosaccharide when it's a ringed form, but it's a monosaccharide now that does not have a carbonyl in it. Only the linear forms of monosaccharides have carbonyl groups. Okay? We'll talk more about that in the lab, why that's important. I'll say more about it here too. Slide four now. When we're talking about building bigger carbohydrates out of smaller ones, It's just kind of a word game, but you don't just pop immediately into polysaccharide status. Poly means many, right? Well, two is not many. Three is not many. Eventually, a bigger number is many. And we have other words besides monosaccharide and polysaccharide that are in between those sizes. For instance, what we see here is the formation of maltose, which is a disaccharide. Di meaning two. So it's made out of two monomers, two monosaccharides. In this case, two glucoses. So maltose is a two subunit sugar. Now, some books don't say sugar unless it's actually a monosaccharide. Some books use sugar to mean any carbohydrate, really. But in any case, it certainly is a carbohydrate, just like glucose itself is as an individual monosaccharide. But it's a bigger sugar. It's a bigger carbohydrate, but it's not yet huge, right? It's not a polysaccharide, it's just a disaccharide. Well, polysaccharides are made in the same process by linking together monosaccharides. It just happens over and over to get to a big one. But what's important about what I said from the previous slide is that if you are going to link together monosaccharides to make bigger carbohydrates, then you can't use linear monosaccharides to do that. To link them together, you need the ringed form of monosaccharides, which is why you see those here. All right? But if you look at these structural formulae, you see that each of the two glucoses, which are identical, these are two identical glucoses used here, but like I said in the opening slide, one of the two pieces that you're going to join together has an OH somewhere, and the other piece has an H somewhere. And that allows you to take those three atoms out to form water that comes out in the dehydration reaction so that the two can be linked together. That's how maltose is made. Malt sugar, which is what maltose is, made of two glucoses. Well, you can use this two of the same monosaccharides, which this example shows you, or in the bottom you can see that you can use two different monosaccharides. Glucose and fructose can be joined together to make sucrose, which is table sugar. You know, when we say sugar, just like we say salt, even though there's many speaking of, but when you say it in terms of food, salt is sodium chloride, just one of many salts. When we say sugar, we mean sucrose usually. Which is just one of many sugars. But sucrose is also a disaccharide, just made of different monosaccharides. The dehydration reaction is identical, though. One piece loses an OH, the other loses an H. And you can continue that. No one's saying that you have to stop there, right? Because now you have a bigger piece now, but you still have OHs and Hs hanging off of it, so you can build it bigger and bigger. That's how you eventually get to polysaccharide status. Okay, so now in slide 5, we finally get a view of an official polysaccharide. And there's two different versions here, or two examples. Starch on the left, glycogen on the right. Now, these are both large molecules because many monosaccharide subunits in the ring form have been hooked together. But there are two major reasons that organisms do this, link together a bunch of monosaccharides to make a polysaccharide. Two reasons to do that, which is why there are two major categories, functionally speaking, of polysaccharides. Two categories based on what they do for the organism. One category is shown here in both of these examples. Both of these examples, starch and glycogen, are classified as storage polysaccharides. I'll just tell you now, even though it's not on this slide, that the other category, besides storage polysaccharide, is structural polysaccharide. Now, a storage polysaccharide gets its name because the reason it's being built is to efficiently store energy for later use. Carbohydrates are the primary source of energy in any cell, not just your cells. So they contain a lot of useful energy in their bonds, which is what Unit 3 is going to be all about when we get there. They're the primary source of energy. And although different monosaccharides can be used for energy, the one that's used most often, the so-called master fuel for all kinds of cells, all organisms, is glucose. Glucose is the chief fuel for any cell. And storage polysaccharides store glucose for its asset of being a good energy source. When an organism has more energy in the form of glucose than is actually required at the moment, for us animals, for instance, we take in a meal. A lot of that meal consists of glucose once it's digested. So that gets absorbed into the body, into the bloodstream. We only need so much fuel at the moment, right? Depending on the activity level. But, you know, because of how we eat, we don't just eat tiny amounts continuously. We eat meals and get a huge dose of glucose all at once, way more than we need at the moment. Well, we don't want to waste that stuff. So we've evolved mechanisms to efficiently store it for later use. We could store it as individual glucoses, which it has to be in order to use it for fuel. But it would take up more room to do that. So we link the extra glucoses that we have, which are start out as individual monosaccharides, put them all together to make a polysaccharide for later storage when we need it. Plants do this for exactly the same reason as we animals do this, but they link their glucoses together slightly differently. Now, in both of these, starch on the left, glycogen on the right, every one of the monomers in these polysaccharides is glucose. I just told you that you don't have to use the same monosaccharide over and over, but in these examples, starch and glycogen, you do, which makes sense because I told you that glucose is the primary fuel. So if you're making this polysaccharide to store your fuel, it makes sense to use nothing but glucose. So every one of these green hexagons is a glucose, but notice that they are hooked together slightly differently. Starch made by plants doesn't branch as much. Notice there's a branch here. There isn't any branch on this one, but there is a branch here. We animals put them together slightly differently with more branching, and our version of the storage polysaccharide is glycogen. This is a major function of your liver. The liver receives that huge volume of glucose from a meal, hooks them together to make glycogen for later. That keeps your glucose level in the blood from skyrocketing. And then hours later, when you have continuously been using your fuel, but you haven't eaten in hours, the liver will reverse the process and dismantle the glycogen it made earlier into individual glucose molecules, which it then puts back into the blood, keeping the glycogen level from dipping. That's very important because, unlike the rest of the body, the brain uses glucose as fuel almost exclusively. Other kinds of cells can use other energy sources besides glucose, but the brain needs a continuous stream for exactly one lifetime. That's how you die often. Your brain starves of glucose. I shouldn't say you die often. That's often how people die. So that's an important function. But We're storing it efficiently by hooking them together because you get rid of all those waters when you undergo the dehydration reactions. That's what makes it more efficient as storage. Now, 6 shows you starch again on the left. That's exactly what we just looked at. Different picture, but it's the same stuff. Cellulose is on the right, though, and cellulose is an example of a structural polysaccharide. Now, cellulose is also made of nothing but glucose, but it's made for a different reason. Structural polysaccharides are built to be structures, not for stored energy. They're not going to be dismantled and burned for fuel. Those big molecules are structural devices, like strands in a plant, for instance. Tough structures. Glucose in both cases, but notice that there's 2 different versions of glucose being used here. Alpha on the left and beta on the right. So not only does glucose exist in 2 forms with respect to linear or ringed form, but there's also 2 ringed forms. And the only difference you can see here is the position of this OH that's on carbon number 1. Each of these corners, if it's not labeled with another symbol, if there's no symbol there, then it's implied that that's carbon. So there's a carbon there, 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 but oxygen there. Well, anyway, at this first carbon, the only difference between these two is that the hydroxyl is above the plane here and it's below the plane here. Remember we talked about chirality, which comes up when a carbon is bonded to 4 different things. This, 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 and this are different from each other, right? So just like that tetrahedron I said, to make one into the other, you have to break a bond and put it into the mirror image. That's why this remains this way, the alpha and the beta remains that way. And they, therefore, when you hook them together, make different structures. If you use alpha monomers, linking them together, you make starch, which is a storage polysaccharide. Hook them together with beta monomers, and you make cellulose, which is like little ropes, structural stuff. By the way, when a dehydration reaction occurs between 2 monosaccharides to make a bigger saccharide, whether it's just a disaccharide or bigger, that individual bond that occurs between the 2 subunits, the 2 monomers formed by a dehydration reaction, gets a special name in the case of 2 monosaccharides being hooked together. And that name, I probably had it on the screen before, is a glycosidic linkage. Yeah, it was shown here on slide 4. A glycosidic linkage is the name of the actual bond between 2 adjacent monosaccharides that are hooked together. We'll have different names for specific bonds between subunits for the other categories of macromolecules. We'll talk about that later. So storage and structural polysaccharides function for different reasons. Slide 7 shows you the cellulose we just looked at. Each individual cellulose molecule is enormously long. It's a bunch of glucoses over and over, forming a single fiber, basically. And then if you have a bunch of those long cellulose fibers, you can bind them together, just like the individual strands of a rope can be put together in parallel, making the overall rope much stronger than just one strand would be. Okay, so this is strong stuff. It's hard to break those bonds. It stands up to abuse. And so operates just as ropes, meaning it withstands tensile forces that try to stretch it. While we're still at this picture, let me mention that, let me just backtrack just slightly for a better picture. When you look at slide 4, notice that monosaccharides don't have just one H or just one OH. There's a bunch of H's and OH's to choose from, right? That means, and all around the ring, basically, That means when you hook two monosaccharides together, there isn't just one position that that can happen at. And this is why polysaccharides made out of multiple monosaccharides can be branched. Right? This is just using one of the H's and OH's. That means this same sugar can be a connection point to another monosaccharide down here. That would be a branch point. That's important because that branching doesn't happen for all four macromolecules, not for all three polymers. In fact, of the polymers, only polysaccharides can branch. The other two do not branch, the other two being nucleic acids and proteins. But I'll mention that again when we get to those two others. All right, let's go now to 8. And in 8, we have an example of a cow, a fellow mammal, which eat a lot of grass. Grass, being a plant, contains a lot of cellulose. Cellulose is chock full of glucose. It's made of nothing but glucose, right? Which I told you is useful in terms of energy. But when we eat cellulose, which we do when we eat plants, we can't get any nutritive value from the cellulose. It's indigestible. It doesn't mean it's worthless. It's important in our diet as fiber, as roughage. It helps things pass through the alimentary canal. But we can't digest it, so we can't bring it into our body. Even though it's pure glucose, we can't get any energy out of that. And the reason we can't is because breaking the glycosidic linkages between those beta monosaccharides, those beta glucoses, which you would have to do to dismantle it small enough to absorb into your body, we can't break those bonds because we don't have the correct kinds of proteins acting as enzymes to break the bonds. And remember, the proteins that any organism is able to make is predefined. There's no limit to the amount of proteins that can be made, but we can make only the ones we have instructions for, namely the genes we have. We don't have the gene that tells our cells to make the protein that could break the links easily. Well, neither does this fellow mammal, the cow. But they get all kinds of energy from eating cellulose. And the reason is, it's not the cow breaking it down. The cow doesn't have the gene for the enzyme either. But in one of its stomachs, it houses trillions and trillions of bacteria that do have the right enzyme to break the bond. This is an example of endosymbiosis. Symbiosis is a word just by itself. Osis means condition, bi as in biology is life, and sim means together. So symbiosis, just as its own word, means the condition of living together. So two species living in especially close relationship. Endosymbiosis is specifically a symbiosis in which one of the species lives inside the other species, like here. And this can happen in different ways. It doesn't necessarily benefit both species involved, but in this case it does. So ecologically it's classified as mutualism. Mutualism is a symbiosis in which both species benefit from the arrangement. So the bacteria are given a nice, safe place with constant temperature, continuous moisture, ideal conditions to reproduce in, and they're given free food continuously. So they're breaking down the cellulose for themselves, of course. They don't care about the cow. But in the process, they also free up a bunch of glucose that can be absorbed through the epithelial lining of the digestive tract of the cow, so they both benefit. If we were to undergo genetic engineering to put the gene coding for the enzyme into our bodies, then we could eat paper and get nutrition from it. But we haven't done that. Okay, slide 9. Well, cellulose is a widespread structural polysaccharide because there's so many plants, for one thing. I mean, wood is mostly cellulose. But I don't want you to get the feeling that plants are the only things that make structural polysaccharides. Animals can as well, including the insect shown here. Chitin is a form of animal structural polysaccharide. It's tough stuff. Insects make it because, unlike us who have endoskeletons, our skeleton is the hard parts of us are interior. Unlike us, those insects have an armor outer layer. Their hardness is outside. And so chitin is made to form that exoskeleton like a suit of armor, which has to be shed now and then as they grow and build a new one. We take advantage of the strength of chitin, though, to make surgical thread, for instance, which has to be tough stuff. Well, that's a brief overview of the polysaccharides category. Let's go on to lipids now, starting with slide 10. And I think I said this before, but it's worth repeating. Lipids and fats are not interchangeable terms. Sometimes people use them interchangeably, but that's wrong. They're both sets of substances, and one set is entirely in the other. It's a proper subset. Stated differently, all fats are lipids, but not all lipids are fats. There are different lipids other than fat, which we'll look at in a minute, but we're starting here with fats. You see it, one fat molecule on the bottom. I showed you a different picture of a fat in the previous chapter. This the one shows you the structural formula better. But fat is one of its three names. These are three interchangeable names that you can use for fat. But most people choose to say fat because it's easiest. Most biologists would call it a triglyceride. And most biochemists would call it a triacyl glycerol. Fat is, of course, easier to say and spell, but doesn't really tell you much about the molecule. Notice that triglyceride and triacyl glycerol both have tri in them, first of all, which is important when you think about how they're built. And they also have glyc in them. Well, let's look at the structure. The tri comes from the part that one fat is made up of three fatty acids. You see one fatty acid connected up at the top. But it's three fatty acids in a fat, each of which individually is connected to a different place on the same three-carbon molecule of glycerol. Now, glycerol is what kind of molecule? Based on its name. It's an alcohol. Alcohols end in OL, right? Just like the word triacyl glycerol. But anything that has a hydroxyl is an alcohol, right? Glycerol, which is just the part in grayish highlighting here, is, if it's not connected to anything, a complete molecule in itself. A three-carbon alcohol. But each of those OHs, of course, includes an H. Each of those hydroxyls includes an H. And therefore, that's a potential connection point for a dehydration reaction to link it with something else. That something else that's being linked in this case, in all three cases of these OHs, are fatty acids. So a fatty acid, just by itself, is also a complete molecule. It would be just the orangish highlighting. So ignore the glycerol for a moment. If you had this just by itself, it would be a complete molecule called a fatty acid. A fatty acid is not a fat. A fatty acid is one potential component of a fat, but it can exist as its own molecule. All the holes are filled in its model. But look at its structure. What do you have on the left end of this fatty acid shown at the top? You have a carboxyl group. Right? C double bonded to an O and also bonded to an OH. That's a carboxyl. That's the only part of the molecule that contains oxygen. That carboxyl group, if it were not there, would mean that a fatty acid is what? In other words, except for the carboxyl, a fatty acid would be what?
Carbon?
No.
Hydrocarbon.
A hydrocarbon. Right? Because all of the rest of the molecule, if you didn't have this carboxyl, is nothing but carbons and hydrogens. So it's not a hydrocarbon because it does have that carboxyl group. But it almost is. And what did I tell you is important about hydrocarbons? Well, several things, but what did I say is true for hydrocarbons in general? Right, they are excellent sources of energy. They make excellent fuels, just like in gasoline, which is a mixture of a bunch of hydrocarbons. This is why fatty acids are such good sources of stored energy as well. If you use them for energy, you get a lot out of each molecule because there's a lot of CH bonds that can be broken to release that energy. So a fatty acid, even though it's not strictly speaking a hydrocarbon, is almost a very, very good source of energy. But what do the carbon-hydrogen bonds also mean for hydrocarbons in general? Other than storing a bunch of energy, what about a carbon-hydrogen bond gives hydrocarbons a property? How would you classify a CH bond? That's right. They are nonpolar because carbon and hydrogen have almost the same electronegativity. So they're equally sharing that pair of electrons in each of these bonds. And that makes hydrocarbons in general not only nonpolar, but unwilling, so to speak, to mix well with polar things. Nonpolar things like to be around other nonpolar things. Polar things like to be around other polar things, but the two don't mix well. Well, oil has a bunch of fatty acids in it, and that's why it doesn't mix with water. Because water is polar, and these are mostly hydrocarbon. Okay, but anyway, a single fatty acid has a carboxyl at its end, and that carboxyl end has an OH in it that serves as the other necessary part for a linkage to occur, right? Glycerol loses an H from one of its OHs. Fatty acid loses an OH from its carboxyl. That comes out as water for the same exact scheme we've been talking about. That's a dehydration reaction. And that sews one fatty acid to the carbon skeleton of the glycerol. But there's two more places where that same thing can happen on the glycerol. So, if you use three fatty acids and do the same thing, you have one fat, or triglyceride or triacyl glycerol. Okay? Now, the same exact thing was used to link two monosaccharides together, but we gave that a special name that applies only when it's monosaccharide you're linking, right? That's glycosidic linkage. Here, the same thing forms what we call an ester linkage. So ester linkages are the bonds between the three individual fatty acids separately bonded to the one glycerol. Now, well, before I go to 10, I mean to 11, let me say that any fat has this form, meaning any fat is made up of a glycerol connected with ester linkages to three individual fatty acids. Glycerol molecules are all the same as each other. There are different types of fats, though. Since they all use glycerol, the fact that there are different fats possible means what must be true. If you can form different fats, but all glycerols are the same, then what has to be true for there to be different fats? Right. It means the other component, the fatty acid, must come in different versions. All glycerols are the same, but not all fatty acids are the same. And therefore, depending on which fatty acid you use, you produce different fats. So triglycerides is a category. Not all fat is the same substance. There are different fats that use different fatty acids. Now, we talked about the fact that a fatty acid has, for most of its tail, just carbons and hydrogens, right? This fat happens to have three identical fatty acids. That doesn't have to be the case, right? These could be different. But how could a fatty acid be different? They all have a carboxyl at the end, and they all have carbons and hydrogens for the rest. How can you imagine them being different from each other? Well, think about building them out of molecules. You get to this carbon, the other end besides the carboxyl. There's nothing saying you have to cap this with a hydrogen in that final place, right? You could add another carbon there for as many as you wanted, really, right? And keep the pattern going. Or you could have stopped here and capped this with a third hydrogen and made it that long only. So fatty acids differ for one reason, because they can be different lengths in terms of the carbon skeleton. That's one way they can differ. Slide 11 shows you a different way, and it has nothing to do with the length. All of the fatty acids in slide 10, the previous one, featured only, ignoring the carboxyl. All of the carbon-carbon bonds, let's just go back so I can show you what I'm talking about. All of the carbon-carbon bonds down the length of the hydrocarbon part of each fatty acid here, those are all single bonds, right? Okay, well, that doesn't have to be the case either if you imagine building them. In slide 11, we can see that it's possible for any pair of carbons in that chain to have a double bond between them, right? Carbon has a valence of 4. So it can spin two of those bonds, making a double bond between the two carbons, and each one just has two more bonds to make, right? Okay, now, if they're only single bonds between carbons, which are represented here, then that means each of these carbons, somewhere in the middle, not all the way at the end, all of these are making only two bonds at the moment, right? So they're not satisfied. So to satisfy the valence, you have to fill in a hydrogen on either side of them, one bond each. Right? Well, if you suddenly make one of the, even just one pair of carbons, a double bond between them, that fills two holes that weren't filled before, right? One on each of the two carbons. And the only way you can do that is to remove hydrogens to make room for that. Okay? This is why we call fatty acids that have only single bonds between their carbons saturated fatty acids. Saturated means full of, right? They're saturated with as many hydrogens as could possibly fit on that chain of carbons, because there's no double bonds taking up any extra bonds. You see what I'm saying there? Any extra holes. So a saturated fatty acid includes as many hydrogens as possible. If a fatty acid has even just one double bond, then that's not including as many hydrogens as it could have if it didn't have that hydrogen bond. And so that's enough to qualify that fatty acid as an unsaturated fatty acid. Those are the two major categories of fatty acids. But there can be degrees of unsaturation, right? Because it's nothing saying you can only make one double bond. You could have several double bonds down the length. And that's why you see food labels with words like polyunsaturated, meaning there's a bunch of double bonds in that. It doesn't have nearly as many hydrogens as a saturated fat. But that's why saturated fats are called that. The saturation means saturated with hydrogens. What you can see on this picture, though, is that if you have a saturated fatty acid, then you have a nice linear tail in that fatty acid. It doesn't bend. I mean, it zigzags, but the zigzag itself doesn't bend. When you put a double bond somewhere, though, that forms a kink in the shape of the overall tail. Now, I've been talking about individual fatty acids, which can be either saturated or unsaturated. We use the same words for fats, though, because fats are made up of fatty acids. So the first fat we saw in the previous slide was an example of a saturated fat. A saturated fat is saturated only if every one of the three fatty acids that make it up are themselves unsaturated. Unsaturated fats have at least one unsaturated fatty acid, which by definition has at least one double bond. You could have all three of them be unsaturated, though, or two of one and one of the other. This bending, though, is important for a reason. It makes a difference with respect to the compactness of the whole package. If you imagine having stiff wires, like coat hanger wire, but just straight pieces, not the whole coat hanger shape. If you have a bunch of straight pieces of stiff wire, which represent individual fatty acids, and you notice you can make them different lengths. You can cut the wire into different lengths, but they're all going to be straight, right? Just like fatty acids can be different lengths based on how many carbons there are. Straightness, though, represents specifically saturated fatty acids. No kinks. If you have a bunch of those, and you don't even have to be very careful if you throw those into a box, they're going to stack nicely, because there's no bends in them. They're going to get close together. They're going to be more compact. More like a solid compared to a liquid, right? Typical solids are more compact in terms of their particles, since the particles are closer together, than liquids. But if you have a bunch of bends in your wires, especially if those bends are at different positions from wire to wire, then you can't just haphazardly throw them into the box. They're going to space out a lot more because of those kinks. Similarly with fatty acids in fats. So plants tend to make mostly unsaturated fats for their lipids, for their fats, with bends. And so they don't pack together nearly as solidly, which is why their fats are usually in the form of oils, more liquid than solid. Animals have a greater fraction of their fats being saturated, straight, and therefore they pack together, forming a more solid than liquid thing like butter. All right? But these are all triglycerides. That's just one type of lipid. In slide 12, we'll go to another truly, truly important lipid that is similar to a fat, but different in important ways. Fats are nonpolar, which is why oil doesn't mix with water, neither does butter. Right? This is not a fat, though, even though it's very similar. It's similar because you still have a glycerol. This is exactly the same thing that you have in a triglyceride. And there are three connection points in glycerol, right? But if it's used for a fat, each one of those connection points is used to connect to a fatty acid to make a triglyceride or fat. Here, only two of those connection points is used to make a connection with a fatty acid. So that's done exactly the way it is in a fat. These are ester linkages right here. Same as for a fat. But the third position on glycerol is used to connect something else other than a third fatty acid. And that something else is a phosphate group, which you should recognize in yellow here. Right, a phosphorus atom and four oxygen atoms around it, one of which is connected to the carbon of the glycerol. And then that phosphate in turn is connected to something else, in this case choline. It doesn't have to be choline. But if you have this arrangement of two fatty acids connected to a glycerol and then a phosphate connected to that same glycerol at the third position, then what you have is not a fat. It's not a triglyceride. It is instead a phospholipid, obviously named for the fact that it includes that phosphate group. Well, the importance of the phospholipid as a molecule, the importance to biology is impossible to overstate. There would be no organisms at all without phospholipids. Well, what is the structural unit of biology? What defines an organism? Has to have at least a cell, one cell, right? Life happens inside cells. That's where the reactions take place. And what defines a cell? How do you know you're looking at a cell? It's not just a space, right? It's a contained space, meaning that there is a boundary between that space and everything else. The plasma membrane is what I'm talking about. That's the boundary that actually defines the cell as being a cell. And every plasma membrane of all organisms that have ever existed are made out chiefly of phospholipids. There's other things in there as well, and we'll talk about membranes a lot more in a different chapter. But the main component of any phospholipid of any organism, of any plasma membrane of any organism, is phospholipids. And the reason for that is because, unlike fats, which are polar, phospholipids are examples of amphipathic molecules. Now, the pathic part of that refers to feeling. Of course, the molecule doesn't have any feelings, but we're anthropomorphizing it. But it's same root as in like empathy or sympathy, pathos. What about amphi? What does that prefix mean? Or what do you see it? What other words do you see amphi in? Yeah, amphitheater is a good example. What makes a theater an amphitheater? The fact that it is partly indoors and partly outdoors. So there's a duality to it, indoor-outdoor in that case. Or amphibian. The bi part of amphibian, just like in biology, means life. Amphi means dual. Dual or both. So an amphibian is so named because it lives part of its life in water, part of its life on land. It's a dual lifestyle. Amphipathic means having dual feelings, which of course not
strictly true, but what it's really referring to here is that an amphipathic molecule is one that has part of its structure being polar and another part of that same molecule being nonpolar. The cartoon version of a single phospholipid is always drawn this way. A circular head with two tails. The head includes the phosphate and whatever is connected to it. And notice that, or recall, when you looked at functional groups, that the phosphate group actually includes an ionized oxygen. It has a charge. That, of course, is going to make it polar, right? Actually, beyond polar. Fully charged, which is even more polar than polar. On the other hand, the tails, which are fatty acids, are almost entirely hydrocarbon, as we've talked about, right? Which are nonpolar because carbon and hydrogen have the same electronegativities. So the overall phospholipid is amphipathic because it has a polar part of it and a nonpolar part of it. The word polar corresponds to the word hydrophilic, which literally means water-loving. Hydrophile would be someone who loves water. Philic means loving. Hydrophobic, water-fearing, corresponds to nonpolar. And that just is linguistically telling you what I've already told you, that polar things like to be around other polar things. So hydrophilic things are polar. They like being around water because water is also polar. Hydrophobic things are nonpolar. They don't like being around water because water is polar. Well, this is a single phospholipid. But if you have millions of them, they will automatically arrange themselves without any life into two layers, which is how membranes got started before there were any true organisms yet. That's how the first cells formed, just because of the amphipathic nature of phospholipids. And we'll go through that again in more detail in a different chapter, but right now we can see in slide 13 these two layers. So this is not a cell. This is not a plasma membrane. This is simply a phospholipid bilayer, because there's no other kinds of molecules here. It's just pure phospholipids. So in a completely lifeless environment of pure water and just a bunch of phospholipids, if you have those two components, just two chemicals, the phospholipids will arrange themselves automatically. You're only seeing a cutaway view, but in three dimensions, it would form a sphere of two layers. This is one layer called a monolayer. This is the other layer, the other monolayer. Together they make up the bilayer. The reason they do this is because all the tails are hydrophobic. They're trying to stay away from the water molecules that are on the inside of this little bag and the outside of this little bag. The polar heads, on the other hand, like being around the water. So they have no problem being either directly against the inside water or the outside water. All parts of them are satisfied. And that's how cells began. But this is not a complete plasma membrane, because even though this does form a boundary between inside and outside, which has to be the case for cells, it doesn't allow certain things through it that actually have to be able to pass through it in order for a cell to be alive. So a plasma membrane is not 100% phospholipid. It's phospholipids for the substructure, and then there are other things, including proteins and other things, that are in there to allow certain things through that couldn't get through directly the phospholipid bilayer. But no cells without phospholipids, so therefore no life. 14, this is still a lipid. This is another lipid, so we're still in the lipids category.
Does anyone know what this molecule is by looking at it? I showed you two very similar molecules in one slide in a previous chapter that I said had drastically different effects. You remember the two molecules? Yeah, two of there's a lot more than two steroid hormones. Right, there was estradiol, which was an estrogen, and testosterone, which had this ringed part in common. What makes them drastically different are their functional groups, right? But the main structure is similar in all steroid hormones, because all steroid hormones that animals produce, not just us, animals in general, start out as this molecule, which is cholesterol. Also indispensable to the life of an animal. We can't live without cholesterol. It gets a bad reputation because it can cause problems if there's too much of it, but you absolutely cannot live without it. The reason that this is called cholesterol, by the way, well, what does the name cholesterol tell you? It's an alcohol. You can see that it has an OH. That's enough to make it an alcohol. Stare, as in stereo, means solid or three-dimensional. And coal is another name for bile, which cholesterol is a component of. Bile is produced by the liver. It's a rich mixture of a bunch of stuff, including cholesterol. But another name for bile is coal, C-H-O-L-E, which is why another name for the gallbladder, whose function it is to store bile, is the cholecyst, bile bag. Anyway, that's cholesterol, and not only does it serve as the precursor to all the steroid hormones, but it also is the precursor to vitamin D. Vitamin D is a little bit of an exception, because vitamins typically are things that we cannot produce. We need them, they're vital, that's the vita part of it, but we have to get those from some other organism, usually bacteria. We can't produce them, we don't have the biochemical pathways in our cells to do that anymore. But for vitamin D, we actually can produce our own using cholesterol. Cholesterol in the skin gets struck by ultraviolet light from the sun, and that transforms it into something similar but a little bit different, called cholecalciferol, another alcohol, which then travels to the kidney. To the liver. The liver adds another hydroxyl, making it a double alcohol. So that stuff is called calcidiol, diol meaning two alcohols. And then that travels to the kidney, which adds a third one called making it calcitriol, which is the active form of vitamin D. And then calcitriol travels to the intestine, where it greatly helps out in the absorption of calcium. Without the help of the vitamin, we don't get much calcium from the diet, but it comes into the body more easily with vitamin D. Now, cholesterol is the chief animal sterol. Plants don't make cholesterol, which is what I'm a vegan, so I don't take in any cholesterol in my diet. But it doesn't mean I have a zero cholesterol level. If I did, I would be dead. Why do I have positive cholesterol? Because I'm an animal. Animals produce cholesterol. That's why when you eat other animals, you get even more, in addition to what you're building as your own animal. Plants, though, have similar things that are called phytosterols. Plant sterol, literally, because phyto means plant. And fungi do a similar thing as well. Ergosterols.
ergot, meaning fungus.
All right, now, I don't have remaining time to go through this entire slide, but we are now done with lipids. Slide 15 is a overview of protein function, so we're going into protein as the next one. But I usually don't read tables to you, because usually they're summaries. This one, though, I will spend a little bit of time going through. For now, since I don't have time, let me just let you appreciate that proteins as molecules have a hugely diverse set of functions. These different functions that are listed here, notice that they are really drastically different from each other. And so this is just another way of saying what I've already told you, namely that proteins do all of the important jobs in all cells. Now, you can't live without any of these four macromolecule classes, but proteins really do just about everything. And that's why it's true that proteins directly give you your traits. You're able to do what you're able to do because of the proteins that you're able to make. And so proteins is the second polymer that we're going to go over. We already went over polysaccharides. Lipids are not polymers, but proteins are. We'll see how they're built next time.